going to mug me?
Am I going to mug you?
Is that gorgeous or what, eh?
And I believe I can run the decent marathon.
Download Veely now.
At school, Herbert William Mullins' classmates voted him most likely to succeed. By the time he was 25, he would take the lives of 13 men, women, and children with knife.
He cut her open and pulled out all of her intestines and laid them out.
Pistol.
People running for their lives.
Bat.
Bam!
And rifle.
Shoots him, kills him, and drives off.
He would claim to be on an extraordinary mission to save lives through murder.
He's going to do something heroic and significant.
But was this heinous serial killer driven by nature or nurture? We asked the investigators that had to unravel the mystery.
The purpose of my job with Herb Mullin was trying to figure out what made him tick.
And the murderer himself.
They are to blame for causing me to commit the crimes.
Was Herbert William Mullin born to kill?
Prayers every day. I went to church every Sunday. I made sure that I went to confession at least once a month. Between October 13th, 1972 and February 13th, 1973, I did in fact murder 13 people.
In January 1973, Sheriff's Detective Terry Medina encountered a crime scene he would never forget.
You know, when you work homicide as long as I did, there are things that get into your mind that you wish you could not have there anymore. This cabin is one of those scenes that haunts me a little bit.
Medina had been called to a woodland cabin near an old tourist attraction in the Santa Cruz Mountains, known as the Mystery Spot.
It's this place where they advertise the phenomenon of the unknown, where the planet and gravity don't exist as it does in other places. The fact is, the night that these bodies were discovered certainly wasn't the course of nature as we know it.
It was around Christmas time. It was drizzly, rainy, wet. I remember this was a dirt road, and the small cabin was just off to the right.
The cabin was home to 30-year-old Kathy Francis and her family.
There were three bodies that were found in that cabin. There were Mrs. Francis and her two sons, and they were pretty young. The first thing that hit me was this. The Christmas tree was knocked down and the decorations were broken. It was supposed to be such a good time of year. And there was obviously a violent struggle in that cabin. She put up a big fight.
Kathy's boys had been playing Chinese checkers in their bunk. The killer had shot them, then stabbed them with a hunting knife.
One of them he had to pull by the foot to draw closer and stabbed him. You know, it seems so peaceful when you hear those birds. Who would have thought that something this tragic would have happened in such a quiet, pretty place?
The unexplained murder at the mystery spot was just one of many to terrify the laid-back coastal community of Santa Cruz during 4 months of madness.
You know, this was a strange time, to say the least.
The DA came out and called us the murder cap of the world.
A killer was striking indiscriminately.
The community and the people that lived in this county were really on edge.
Young women.
He surprised her and, killed her in a horrible way.
Children.
People were frightened. They didn't have a clue as to who was involved.
A priest.
Oh, my God. It raised the hackles of so many people.
The elderly.
We haven't had anything like this in Santa Cruz County before, and I hope to God we never have anything like this again.
No one was safe.
This was going on with unbelievable frequency.
We've had so many. When will this stop?
There was a lot of pressure on the police and the detectives. There's so many bodies turning up.
They were killed in very, very different ways, under different sets of circumstances. And from a law enforcement perspective, you can't make really a connection between these people.
Then on February the 13th, 1973, a single rifle shot would ring out on the Santa Cruz cliffs, and the mystery would begin to unravel. 73-year-old Fred Perez was starting some gardening when a young man drove into the quiet neighborhood.
Driving down the street on a Sunday morning, an elderly gentleman working in his front yard, and he shoots him, kills him, and drives off.
A neighbor had spotted the car leaving, and police soon stopped it. The occupant was 25-year-old Santa Cruz resident Herbert William Mullin, a seemingly mild-mannered young man.
He was unassuming, withdrawn, quiet.
If you looked at him and talked to him, you'd think he was a law-abiding citizen. He was interested in the community. He was a moral person. That's what he was on the face of it.
But investigators soon realized there was more to this quiet and polite young man than met the eye.
In Santa Cruz, California, 25-year-old Herbert Mullin was charged with the fatal shootings of 6 persons in the past 3 weeks.
Herbert Mullin was suspected of as many as 13 murders.
Mullin, who had been voted the most likely to succeed in his high school class and held a college scholarship, reportedly was involved with the Santa Cruz drug culture.
With Mullin in custody, detectives, including defense investigator Harold Cartwright, began searching for an answer to the question on everyone's lips. Why?
The purpose of my job with Herb Mullin was trying to figure out what made him tick.
Cartwright's investigation would begin in Mullin's small hometown of Felton, nestled amongst the redwoods of the Santa Cruz Mountains.
This is San Lorenzo Valley High School. Herb Mullin graduated from here in 1965. He was voted most likely to succeed. He was an excellent student from all we've been able to determine. He was well-liked, good football player, even though he was quite small. Here's this wonderful young man, and a few years later, he's a mass murderer and a serial killer. I mean, that's not something that happens to the average person. What happened?
No one could have known it, but the moment of Herbert Mullin's birth would later take on a terrible and tragic significance.
My name is Herbert William Mullin, and I was born on April 18th, 1947, at 6:06 a.m. My earliest memory was I was crawling on my hands and knees and I was looking into a puddle. I saw myself and the redwood trees reflected and the sunlight, the sun, and I touched the sun with my finger and it created little circular waves extending outward in all directions. I felt peaceful and calm, inquisitive, curious, content, grateful, and hopeful.
So what had turned this optimistic infant into a killer?
I remember one of the first times I ever got him to say anything in response to one of my questions. We were there, and he wasn't having anything of it, and he finally looked at me, and he just looked up on the table, and he said, "When God speaks to you, you listen."
Investigators were about to uncover one of the most bizarre stories in criminal history. In February 1973, Santa Cruz resident Herbert William Mullin had been arrested for the seemingly random shooting of an old man working in his yard. As Mullin was interviewed by detectives and doctors, he began to reveal the details of 12 more murders that had terrified the community, along with an extraordinary motive.
I mean, the hair on the back of my neck just stood up. I mean, it sent chills all the way down my spine.
His premise was that he had to save the world after hearing voices.
The voices told him that he was, you know, one of the chosen people, and that it was God's plan, that people had to be sacrificed.
He was going to prevent cataclysmic earthquakes by killing people.
The earthquake was going to take California into the sea, and he had to perform ritual sacrifices to prevent the earthquake from knocking California into the sea.
Mullin claimed that willing victims would offer themselves to him telepathically. Though Detective Medina hadn't realized it at the time, in October 1972, he'd responded to the first of Herbert Mullin's murders.
At the time, I was just thinking I'm going to another murder scene.
The body was that of familiar local hobo Lawrence White, known as Whitey.
We're only about a mile from the city of Santa Cruz. We got called to an area right off the road here. And there was an old man, dead, obviously been bludgeoned.
Mullin knows that the people who will be willing sacrifices will let him know telepathically they're ready to die. And that's exactly what he says happens. He sees a man on the road, he drives by, he hears a man say, "I'm Jonah, throw me over." There's the first one.
He parked a 58 Chevy Nomad, put the hood up. The universal sign of distress, there's something wrong with the car. Who should come along? Poor old Whitey. He had Whitey looking under the hood. Mullin comes around with a baseball bat while Lawrence White's looking. Bam!
Kills him.
Of course, you start to look who his associates are, and that's usually, in these cases, you know, that's where the connection is. Wow. All of his friends were trying to help us. He didn't have an enemy. Nobody could say, oh, there was an argument, there was a conflict, he owed money. It was just an old man beat to death on the side of a road.
The investigation into Lawrence White's death would lead to a dead end. But on October the 24th, Herbert Mullin would strike again, offering a ride to 24-year-old Cabrillo College student Mary Guilfoyle.
He was going to take her to a particular location. She soon realized that she wasn't on her way to that location. He surprised her and killed her in a horrible way right there in the car.
He not only stabbed her, but he essentially cut her open. pulled out all of her intestines and laid them out.
The once popular high school student was now killing without remorse.
With Guilfoyle, there was blood in his, on the floor mat of his vehicle, and he talked to me about how he could never get all that blood off the floor mat. There wasn't any emotion when he talked about killing these people.
And now Herbert Mullin was about to commit a crime that would shock the whole community to its very core. All Souls Day, November 72. Herbert Mullin enters St. Mary's Church in Los Gatos. Beloved local priest Father Tomei is taking confession.
This priest, who is extremely well-respected, had been a World War II French resistance fighter.
Mullin had been raised as a Catholic. He went there for confession.
I was thoroughly indoctrinated into the ideas and concepts and belief systems of Roman Catholicism. Many of those doctrines and concepts require a great deal of faith that isn't based on logic or reasoning. I think that was detrimental to my mental health.
He went into the confessional and discussed some things. One would hope it was his previous killings.
He then opens the door to the confessional and he stabs the priest in the heart.
Mullin would later claim that Father Tomei had willingly offered himself as a sacrifice.
The thing that was so awful about it was that the priest was, even after being stabbed, dying, bleeding to death, still said words to the effect that he forgave him for what he had done. It's almost like the crucifix scene.
So what had driven Mullin to such a shocking crime? Sheriff's detective Terry Medina also began to delve into Mullin's childhood.
During the investigation, we had to interview his parents. And, you know, his mother was just a very nice, typical mom of the time. Herb's father, he was a regular guy. He worked for the post office. He was a former Marine, but he was very strict. I mean, there was a bright line of right and wrong.
I entered St. Stephen's Grammar School. I was a good student, I think, from my point of view. I always did my homework at night. I was always on first team. I was a pretty good athlete. I thought that it was leading me towards a beneficial lifetime, you know, so that I could be a good member of my family and the community.
Detailed investigations failed to turn up anything significant or unusual about Mullin's childhood until his late teens.
After high school, he started clearly deteriorating mentally.
Mullin began to change.
I'd been dating a girl during 1964, 65, and 66, and 67. In 1967, we became engaged to be married. I think that is basically when mental health issues started to take effect.
I spoke with his high school girlfriend, a nice young woman. They got engaged to be married, and he started acting stranger and stranger, and she was afraid of him at times. He got to where he would didn't want her to make any decisions, and I recall that he would slap her legs if he got annoyed with her, if he got angry with her.
My fiance and my friends were going along with the idea of my parents that I should be kept naive, gullible, and immature.
The young Herb Mullin was beginning to show signs of severe paranoia.
We don't know what triggers a paranoid disorder. There are a lot of theories early on that the reason somebody became paranoid was because they had acted upon homosexual urges and became terrified of the homosexual urge. And so what they would do is they would turn this into, somebody is going to try to get me, they're talking about me, they're going to hurt me, They're conspiring against me. They're going to make me do things that I don't want to do. And this is not a sexual identity problem. I think people would get that confused, that, oh, they're gay and they don't want to be. This is much more of a terror-based feeling.
So what was causing this change in the previously devout, clean-cut Catholic?
When I spoke with Herb's sister, she mentioned the first time that she really became concerned about her brother was he was having dinner with their family, and he started mimicking everything her husband did. If her husband picked up a fork or a knife, he would pick up a fork or a knife. If her husband got up and went to the sink, he would get up and go to the sink. And this went on for some period of time, and she described it as him like he was being in a trance, that he really wasn't in control of what he was doing. He was just being controlled by his brother-in-law.
This trance-like mimicking is known as echopraxia and can be a symptom of schizophrenia.
It used to be thought of as a young person's disease. The schizophrenic frequently doesn't manifest symptoms until late teens or early 20s, although there are exceptions to that.
Mullin would also allege that his high school friend, Jim Genera, had turned him onto mind-altering drugs.
Two illegal drugs that I was became familiar with was marijuana and LSD.
Mullin dropped Catholicism in favor of an obsession with Eastern religions and registered as a conscientious objector. His family began to believe drugs were the cause of the extreme changes in his behavior.
A lot of people at that time, including his parents, thought it was because he was experimenting with marijuana and LSD. I don't believe that at all.
We could never find anything that indicated that at some point in his life his drug life snapped him into some other reality. It just didn't seem to be there.
It may have been connected with some of his psychedelic drug taking, but that will not by itself make somebody permanently psychotic unless the person was already tending toward that or had begun to show some signs of it.
Mullin himself, however, disagrees.
I was talked into using LSD by other people that I knew at that particular time, people that I had gone to high school with. With the fourth victim, I asked that guy if he had any marijuana. I know that both marijuana and LSD were very, very detrimental to my mental health.
By January 1973, Mullin had killed a hobo, a college girl, and a priest. His next killing would be much more personal.
He felt that Genera had introduced him to marijuana, and that had been the thing that had really ruined his life. So at some point, he became fixated on this idea that Genera was responsible for all of Herb's problems.
Genera, crime scene, was horrific also. Mullin, at that point, he had a gun.
He shot Mr. Genera, and he took a knife and stabbed Mrs. Genera.
Well, that's the messy part of his delusion, is that he blames the person who introduced him to drugs, and that whole thing doesn't fit with his idea that people are volunteers. But on the other hand, it's more like, well, you know, I've got to kill people, might as well get that guy too and punish him. That's not really part of the vision.
The Genera's death would provide the explanation for the mystery spot murder. Earlier that morning, at her cabin, Kathy Francis had given Mullin Jim Genera's address. She would pay for her kindness.
He went back to the Francis house, which clearly showed that he was covering his trail. He killed her and her two boys.
And Mullin's murderous mission was far from over. In 1973, Herbert Mullin had been arrested for multiple murders he claimed he'd committed to save California from a cataclysmic earthquake. Several days after Mullin's arrest, Sheriff's Detective Terry Medina was called to another terrible scene in the Redwoods Forest.
This area is in Henry Cow State Park, but it's not in the part of the park that people go to, you know, where there's a picnic table and a place to put up your tent. This is a remote part of the park not used for that purpose. It's just a mountain area. I haven't been here since we were at the crime scene.
There's no question about it. It's very unusual. We haven't had anything like this in Santa Cruz County before, and I hope to God we never have anything like this again. I think people are definitely a little uptight. They don't know exactly what we have running loose around here, and they're very concerned.
In a makeshift shelter, four teenage campers had been found murdered, each coldly dispatched by a bullet to the head. But Herbert Mullin was in custody, so the killer of the boys was a mystery.
By the time we could make the assessment, it was starting to get dark. The bodies were not going to be removed. Somebody had to stay there all night long. I was one of the people that had to stay there overnight. And that was the most eerie crime scene I'd ever done. It was, you know, cops never want to admit that they get afraid. But I'll tell you, not knowing who the suspect is, not knowing if the suspect is going to come back. Everybody has gone from this mountain except for us two and the deceased. I'd say we were afraid.
Autopsies would later reveal that the boys' bodies had been there a week, and the bullets that had killed them belonged to Herbert William Mullin. He had killed them before his arrest. Their choice of campsite had cost them their lives.
One of my favorite pastimes, I enjoy the outdoors, walking in the redwoods, and exploring the mountainous regions.
He had violated some rules and been kicked off property, and when he saw them doing it in violation of the rules, he just didn't think that they should be there either. He wants people to be punished for infractions. That's not at all surprising in someone with paranoid schizophrenia.
Mullin claimed the teenagers had told him telepathically that they were willing sacrifices. He'd entered the tent and opened fire.
They were basically trapped. God, I don't know what would have gone through their mind.
Mullin found a rifle at the camp, and it was that weapon that he used on the 13th of February, 1973, to shoot Fred Perry's in his yard, his 13th and final victim. But although the shooting of Perry's had led to Mullin's capture, it did little to explain why the former All-American kid had turned into a ruthless serial killer. In his investigations into Mullin's life, Harold Cartwright had discovered that by 1971, the boy once voted most likely to succeed was living in cheap hotels in San Francisco's Tenderloin district.
You have to understand, during the 70s, the Tenderloin of San Francisco was a pretty rundown, you know, parts of it were really bad, and there were drug addicts and winos, and it was a pretty seedy place.
Here, the pacifist and devotee of Eastern religions had developed a surprising obsession.
When Herb was living in San Francisco, he got into boxing, and I located the gym, and I remember the trainer's name was Vic. The way Vic described him as strange,
But he liked the kid because he had a real strong will. He would spar with people who, much better boxers, and take a pretty good beating. But he would keep right on and keep coming back. He described him as having a lot of guts.
I don't think that I had a conscious intention to engage in that much boxing every day, or 4 or 5 days a week for 6 months.
Herb was really focused whenever you were there telling him what to do and coaching him all the time. But if you turned your back on him for a couple of minutes, when you turned around, he would be standing in the corner of the ring and he would be talking to himself, like he was carrying on a conversation with another party.
I wanted to program myself to become a successful citizen. And somewhere in my subconscious, I focused on my father and how he had told me he had been boxing and so forth during his formative years. And so possibly I engaged in that violent activity because of my desire to be more like him in terms of the success story of a normal, natural person in America.
It's not unusual to search for something that will make you better, whatever that better is. It's very painful to be out of sorts to that degree. And the psychological pain is something that many schizophrenics will talk about at some point, that they can't stand the pain that they're in.
In the Tenderloin, Cartwright located one of the decrepit hotels where Mullin had lived.
I located one landlady. She had some boxes in her basement that he had left when he moved, and they were filled with Herb's crazy writings and drawings and hundreds of pages that really didn't make any sense at all.
One of the symptoms of certain types of schizophrenia or in other kinds of learning disorders is hypergraphia, where a person just writes and writes. Sometimes they'll write all over the walls, all over their bodies. They'll keep journals. They'll write endless letters to the president. It's not that they need to put things in writing for any particular readers. It's just a compulsive recording of details, details, details.
He composed great heaps of literature, which was essentially undecipherable while he was there.
These seemingly senseless writings would contain hidden codes that provided a terrifying glimpse of Herbert Mullin's future intent.
There's a lot of material about the 12 apostles plus one, clearly implying that he was the 13th disciple of God.
Mullin was beginning to develop his theories for how he would save California from natural disaster.
He comes across a death date that's very significant. It's Albert Einstein's. And Albert Einstein died on his birth date, April 18th, which also coincides with the San Francisco earthquake of 1906.
Nobody can say what percentage of schizophrenics have it, but it's very common. A magical belief about certain numbers occurs as one of their delusions.
So in the mind of a delusional person, what he sees is Einstein died to protect the people who were born on April 18th. And those people now had a mission to protect everybody else. So he's going to do something heroic. He gets very involved in looking at all the numbers of death rates all over the place and then looking at natural disasters and seeing how, well, look here now, death rates go down and we have a hurricane or an earthquake. So is the earth trying to balance itself out? He's got to think of a way to murder people to bring the death rate up to stave off the earthquake.
Herbert Mullin would choose the 13th day of October 1972 to begin the devastating four-month killing spree that would claim the lives of 13 innocent people. His final victim, again, slain on the 13th of the month. But were Mullin's murders really driven by delusions? And would his insanity mean he could escape punishment for his crimes? In 1973, the trial of Herbert Mullin would in turn shock, baffle, and repulse the jury, and test their concept of the term insanity to the limit. That he was guilty of murder was in little doubt, but whether he was legally responsible was.
When these horrible crimes occur, I think we're sort of conditioned to think they must be crazy. That sets the stage for a battle over whether they are therefore legally insane.
The state of mind is really what this case turned out to be all about.
Well, this is the courtroom where the trial occurred. It was Judge Kranich's courtroom. On this side is where the defense team sat.
From the moment Mullin had met his court-appointed attorney, his behavior had been bizarre.
Herbert Mullin said he didn't want me because I didn't look sufficiently like Richard Nixon. This was not exactly at the height of Nixon's popularity. It was apparent that he was dingy as a bedbug.
As the trial progressed, any lingering doubt that Mullin had been the perpetrator of all the crimes soon vanished.
Mr. Mullin normally sat in this chair. He would interrupt the proceedings from time to time. He would get very excited and say something to his attorneys when somebody was describing the location of a body or how many stab wounds there were, so on and so forth. When somebody's doing that, they're obviously incriminating themselves.
Although it was clear to all that Mullin was mentally ill, was he insane enough to avoid full responsibility for the crimes?
Even a diagnosis of severe mental illness is not the equivalent of legal insanity. Legal insanity is who should be held morally responsible. In most of the jurisdictions, it's based on the McNaughton rule, which comes from England.
Part of the McNaughton rule is that if you're doing something and you don't know it's wrong, that there's an excusable homicide there. Well, he didn't know what he was doing was wrong, that I could see. He thought he was doing the right thing.
Against all expectations, Mullin made it clear that he wanted to speak.
Mr. Mullin did testify, which is very unusual. He came up, he didn't sit down. He was like this, and he basically gave us all a lecture.
On the stand, Mullin claimed his family, friends, and neighbors had all conspired to drive him to murder, a belief he still holds.
I have tried over the years, even during the trial, I've tried to explain that I felt that my family and the people in charge of my upbringing were sort of playing a killjoy sadistic game on my life, on my mind. I think my family and my neighbors, and they knew that I was committing the crimes.
All those involved with the investigation of Mullin's crimes dismiss his claims as the delusions of a madman.
I've seen so many cases where it's so easy to blame, you know, parents for things that go wrong. If either parent knew exactly what Herb was doing, they would have turned him in. I'm positive of that in my heart.
You know, once a schizophrenic, always a schizophrenic. His parents were wonderful people, and the fact that he might think something is strictly a part of his mental illness.
The thing about someone who's paranoid is that they truly believe that there is a conspiracy against them. You can show this individual proof that what they're thinking is not right, and then you become part of the paranoid pseudo-community.
But would Mullin's madness mean he would escape punishment for his crimes?
The defense in this trial, I gotta tell you, they did a great job. I started to think, whoa, are we going to win this case? They said, if you're Herbert William Mullin, two plus 2 equals 5. And everything that derives from that is wrong.
He had a premise from which he operated, and that premise was wacky. And as a result, whatever he did after that, he assumed, I think, that he was doing what he was supposed to do, he was called upon to do. And being a perfectly good citizen, he went about his duties, and his duties included killing people.
After 3 days of deliberation, the jury returned their verdict. Herbert William Mullin was judged to be sane at the time of his crimes and convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder and 8 of second-degree murder. Some would write Herbert Mullin off as just another madman. But is there more to this killer than meets the eye?
There are a lot of paranoid schizophrenics that don't kill people. You know, why did this happen to him?
So what made Herbert Mullin different? Was he born to kill?
Obviously, the seeds were there. Some of the killings that he committed, it seemed as if he was using revenge, killing some of the people that he felt had caused his problems, the marijuana, people defiling nature by camping in the woods. So you have to say, was it done because of real psychosis, or was he using it to justify his murders?
It was not a false claim that he was psychotic. It's a false claim to imply that it was because of a pre-existing paranoid schizophrenia that he took up the gun and knife and bat to kill all these people. That belief system that he had doesn't show that he was unaware that society considered this wrong, that he was violating the criminal law.
If you go into any psychiatric hospital, you'll see somebody who's there and say, why are you here? Well, I heard voices telling me to kill myself. Well, why didn't you kill yourself? I didn't want to kill myself. So I told somebody and they put me in the hospital. It's very, very rare that somebody obeys command hallucinations.
A person who is born with schizophrenia dormant and it does become full-blown illness is born to be ill, but not to kill.
Herbert Mullin, however, continues to argue that his crimes were the result of nurture rather than nature.
I feel that it's the state of California, the court system, the psychiatrists, they should give credence to this contention of mine that I'm not 100% the guilty one in the commission of the crimes. They should give a little leniency and maybe exonerate and vindicate me a little bit. And that's one of my hopes, you know. I'm looking for a sponsor who will assist me in approaching the court system so that I might be able to achieve a parole or a pardon or release from prison.
But mental illness, mental torment that people deal with, I think you have to have some sympathy for. But the story of the victims doesn't really get told enough.
For the investigator that spent months delving into the life and mind of Herbert Mullin, the answer to the question of whether he should be released is a very simple one.
Think of all of the people's lives that he just destroyed. I mean, not just the ones he killed. I think he was crazy as hell. You know, Herb Mullin is, was, will always be a paranoid schizophrenic. And, you know, heaven forbid that he would ever be released from prison.